Hey, this is Steve Earle, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is your old pal, Chris Shiflett. And you are listening to another fine episode of Walking the Floor. Greetings from Bangkok, Thailand, man, where I've got a day off today. Because we played an incredible show last night at the Challenger Hall here. And, you know, if you're so inclined, you can walk out on the street right outside my hotel room and you could eat a deep-fried scorpion on a stick. Or you could just annoy the people that sell those things by photographing them without their consent, which is what I've been getting up to. Anyway, you know, I don't want to be culturally insensitive or anything. That's cool. If you want to eat a deep-fried scorpion on a stick, that's your prerogative. I'm going to hold out for something else. You know, one of the fun parts of doing these shows this past week, we've been in, you know, Japan and South Korea, now here in Bangkok. We got one more show to go in Singapore. One of the fun things about coming over and doing shows in places like this that we don't get to very often is that you get to meet all these people. People fly in from, like, all the surrounding areas and surrounding countries. So I've been meeting lots of nice folks this week from Malaysia and the Philippines and, you know, a bunch of other places that we've never been to or don't get to often. And that's been a real hoot. And I hope everybody's been having a good time. I know that we have. And there's just one more show to go. And then we'll be heading home on Sunday. And I think, you know, with the time difference and everything, I think it's going to exactly work out where I'm going to be sitting in the airport in Singapore Sunday morning, which will be Saturday night back home, when the Mayweather-McGregor fiasco is going on. So I think I'm going to be able to watch that thing live. If I don't get to watch that thing live, I'm going to be a little bit upset because I really don't want to have to get on that plane without knowing the outcome of the fight. Because when that happens, you know, you got to get home as quick as you can and watch it on delay, and you can't, like, look at your phone because your friends are sending you text messages. Whoa, I can't believe Mayweather knocked him out. You know, all that kind of stuff. So hopefully I'll be able to watch that shit in the airport before we get on the plane and head home. And, you know, you don't have to be Floyd Mayweather or Conor McGregor with their hundreds of millions of dollars to go on over to Zounds.com and purchase your dream guitar or whatever else it is that you want for musical gear. Because at Zounds, they make gear affordable. And they allow you to split your order into 4, 6, 8, or 12 monthly payments. And they never charge interest, man. So Zounds.com, where you don't have to make hundreds of millions of dollars like Floyd Mayweather to purchase your dream guitar. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to today's interview. All right, buckle up, ladies and gentlemen, because today's guest is none other than singer, songwriter, playwright, activist, legend, Steve Earle. This is actually Steve Earle's second time on the show, so I guess I didn't blow it too hard the first time because he came back, and I was happy to have him. I love Steve Earle. Steve Earle's one of my heroes. And we got to talk about his great new record, So You Want to Be an Outlaw. It's out now. Go check it out. We talked politics. You know, we're a couple of lefties, so of course we didn't agree, but we talked politics, and that was fun. You know, he's a smart, engaging guy, and I love getting his take on stuff. But we started with something more important than politics, more important than honky-tonk. We started with a discussion of our favorite football team, the almighty Arsenal. So let the hate mail and angry Twitter commentary commence. This is Steve Earle on Walking the Floor.
When a team's in a transitional period like Arsenal is right now, and everybody's trying to figure out what the fuck's going to happen, it all matters.
Right. I mean, I thought they looked pretty good, you know, in their preseason stuff. I don't know how much you watched that stuff.
I saw.
They got
saw
a couple new players that look pretty good. So who knows? I thought it was,
you know, I don't want to be one of those winger or Wenger out people, but it seemed like it was time for him to go at the end of last season. But
yeah,
but
yeah,
he didn't. So he
not, yeah, he's not going to because they, you know, he's got a contract too, and there's right, two more years on it. So yeah, they're not they're not going to buy him out of that contract and pay. These guys spent all that money on that stadium.
So it's, yeah, right.
So
yeah,
it's basically they're not going to pay him what they got to pay him and pay somebody else. They're just not going to do it.
Right.
So that's not going to happen. I don't think it's as much about the manager as people think it is.
I always wonder how much they're actually involved in the day-to-day, like, training of
well,
the team.
Well, the,
you know?
The rap on him, huge... and this was the big criticism from Tony Adams, you know, and that's, of course, Tony's a little out of his mind, but he's like, I met him, we did a radio show together in London, like, when I was over doing the press trip for this tour. You know, he thinks he should be managing Arsenal. He really
right,
does. You know,
well, so, it's funny. I was just on vacation in Spain, yeah, and somebody left a copy of his new book at the hotel.
He was pimping the book.
Right. Yeah. So he just had. It was just there. So I grabbed it and I read it. And it's kind of like a sobriety.
It is.
Book, but and then kind of like his life in football. But he talks about that a lot. Like I was thinking when
his rap on Arsene Wenger is that he's about training is what he's about, but that he's not really a coach.
Because
that's what he changed everything in English football. He's
right,
the guy that came and made those guys.
Made them all
gonna,
fit.
You're not gonna
don't
the,
smoke and drink and all that.
You're not going to sit in the fucking pub the night before. You
right,
know?
Right.
And not going to have it. And he started finding people and he started, you know.
Is that the football equivalent of like, ah, the producer didn't do shit?
Basically.
You know what I mean?
Basically, probably.
Yeah.
You know, but the point is the producer can't make a record out of a band that doesn't have songs.
Right.
You know?
Gotta have something
there. So I think that English Premier League football itself is on the verge of becoming the fucking NBA.
Right.
Where the inmates are in charge of the fucking asylum all the time. They're making enough money and there's enough. And the way they still treat them like fucking human beings, like it's almost like white slavery and black slavery, the way that they trade players, they sell them, you know?
Right, sure, yeah.
You can't do that in U.S. sports. It is kind of done, but it's not done outright there.
Right.
You know, you can get your contract sold. You have nothing to
say. Well, we have that whole thing going on with Sanchez right now. So,
right,
yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll see,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, the deal there is he's just... You know, he doesn't like Wenger and he doesn't like being told what to do. That's what that was.
Well, Wenger kept referring to like something that had happened in the middle of the season.
Yeah.
And he said he was going to talk about it, but then he never did. But it seemed pretty clear that it was some sort of conflict with Sanchez.
Well,
but he's like our best player and he's like the only guy on the pitch half the time that's giving 110%, so it'd be sad to see him leave.
Yeah, because some of the other guys, I don't know what they're doing. We had a lot of guys that were doing the contracts. But we'll see what happens. I think it could be. We'll see.
So I went back and listened to our first interview
right,
last night because I was like, oh, God, make sure I don't ask him the same question.
Right.
And that one was kind of like the, you know, this is your life, go through the timeline. How did you
wind up playing guitar, blah, blah,
all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to, mostly I want to talk to you about your new record. But I also wanted to ask you about, like, what do you do outside of music and creative stuff? Besides, like, writing plays, and what do you do besides creative endeavors? You know what I mean? Like, do you have hobbies? Are you like,
yeah,
I'm really into stand-up paddleboarding? Like, you know, what do you do to chill out?
I fish with a fly rod, and I don't get to do it that often. I fish maybe 4 or 5 days a year, you know, but I get to go to some of the best places, but I'm going to get a day in Idaho this trip.
Okay.
On
tour? Like, do you bring your stuff with you on tour?
Yeah. Yeah. I keep a couple of rods on the bus all the time. Cause you can never know. Like I was opening for Jackson Browne at, you know, Chastain Park in Atlanta, you know, that venue. It's like, yeah, you guys were kind of came too big for it, but it's like a concert series, you know, band show kind of thing. But Jackson was playing there and I did a whole tour with him, like, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe longer than that, probably 15 years ago. And I just started fishing with a fly rod or just really getting into it. And I had a fly rod on the bus and I was watching, there were these young black kids, like a couple of them, just, they were catching sunfish a little bigger than your hand, you know, with drop lines. So I went and got some popping bugs, just little flies that sort of bounce across the water when you jig them across and
right,
start throwing them out there. Caught 20 of those sunfish and released them before sound check, you know.
Oh, really?
So I keep it on there all the time so I can... I'm mainly a trout fisherman. I'm not into the big dick fishing, like, you know, like big salmon runs and all that stuff because I like to... Trout don't live in ugly places and
right.
you know, there's a little, you stalk them, you know, you have to, I like, and I've never done the saltwater thing, and I want to try that, because that's all sight fishing. You're in flats in a flatboat throwing flies right on the nose of, you know, a big snook or bonefish, and they hit them, and they hit them really hard. And,
right.
And it's, you know, they're big rods, they're like 9 foot, you know, 8 weight rods, so they're way bigger than I'm used to, but.
Let's talk about your new record. Is the name of your new record, So You Want to Be an Outlaw, is that like in response to sort of the current wave of, you know, Americana artists that are sort of drawing from that sound, that four on the floor kind of classic country
sound?
Yeah,
I didn't really realize that they were, you know, I mean, I go through periods of not listening to any music at all. I hate to say that, but I do. And but there
we all listen to podcasts now, right?
Yeah, but well, it's weird. It's like, yeah, it gets all kind of, yeah, people, nothing's as concentrated as it was, yeah. You know, no kind of culture, no kind of media is, but you know, I hear things and I don't, you know, I'm a big fan of Coulter Wall, kind of blows my mind. There's this singer songwriter, he's 21. He's from the
Canadian
middle.
Guy.
Yeah. He's in the middle of nowhere in Saskatchewan. And he's like the best young singer songwriter I've seen in 20 years. He's really, really good. I mean, he came writing songs that are, he has this voice that sounds like he's 80 or something,
right. But
he's
super deep, right?
He talks that way. It's just, you know, I thought it was a fake. And then I met him and who talks with like way down like this, and you know, it's but his songs are like alliterated way past the decimal point, really incredibly well written songs. And you don't see that so much. I mean, there's a sort of new model school of songwriting that is poetic but not necessarily a lot of craft applied to it, because it was just decided that it was acceptable or decided that it wasn't cool or whatever, you know?
Right.
And I kind of came up, you know, I do like the songs that have literary level, you know, images and devices, literary devices in them. I like stuff that's you know, with recognizable IAMs and you know, stuff that you lay it out on a page and you look at it, and it actually works when you put it on a page just almost as well as it does when you sing it.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because I know you've done some like songwriting seminars and things like that where you teach young songwriters. Yeah. Like, what is the advice that you give to them beyond what you just said?
You can't write anything if you don't read, and that, you know, songs themselves are, it's great to listen to other songs, but it's important to read too and to consider. If you're writing, what I write and is what I teach is post Bob Dylan songwriting that is intended to be literature.
And, right.
You know, I'm not willing. It's cool, and I've written stuff that maybe didn't rise to that, but I try not to, and it's like, you know, it's just one of those things. It's been, you know, there's this moment when, you know, Bob wants to be John Lennon and John Lennon wants to be Bob that kind of made rock and roll art.
Right.
But other than that, it would just take Cars and Girls, I think. And, right. And which would have been fine, but we wouldn't have had a lot of stuff. We wouldn't have had, you know, Blonde on Blonde and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Pet Sounds. And,
sure.
And, you know, the Led Zeppelin records, you know, which are like, everybody thinks that this, Led Zeppelin's not a proto-metal band. They had songs. That's right. What made them who they were. Nirvana is Nirvana because that guy was a great fucking songwriter.
Right. You know, well, who were like the country guys of that era, you know, coming out of the 60s into the 70s that
well, you know, Johnny Cash, you know, I mean, for us, like people like me, you know, that sort of had 1 foot in country music and 1 foot in rock and roll. It's all about Johnny Cash. Because, I mean, there's other people too, Buck Owens and, you know, I heard Buck Owens and the Beatles on the same radio station growing up.
Right.
You know, because he did have pop hits, but, you know, you probably didn't hear him in New York City. I don't know whether they played Tiger by the Tail in New York City right after, you know, Help, but they did in San Antonio, you know. Mm. So, but Johnny Cash, by the time I got a guitar and, you know, I'm 12, 13, Johnny Cash show was on. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm this kid with long hair and cowboy boots and getting the shit kicked out of me on an almost constant basis. And all of a sudden, here's a TV show where I can see, you know, Neil Young and Bob Dylan and Merle Haggard and, you know, Derek and the Dominoes. The only time that I ever saw Derek and the Dominoes was on that show. But you see Mother Maybelle Carter herself, you know, the Carter family, the Statler brothers and Carl Perkins every week because they were part of it. And Norman right. Blake was the musical, you know, the hillbilly side of the musical direction thing because he could write charts. So he was the liaison between the orchestra and the country players. Mm. He was sort of the go-between between them. And it was just I did not miss that television show. And the Tom Jones show was close to that cool because, you know. Tom Jones had a television
show. Tom Jones, the singer?
Yeah, he had a television show. It was English, but it was on ABC in the States, which was the same network that Cash was on. Mm. And it was, I saw Joe Cocker for the first time on that show, you know, before Woodstock. And I saw Janis Joplin was on it, you know, people. And I think it's the only place I ever saw Creedence Clearwater Revival on television was on. I think Creedence may have been on Cash, but I think I missed it. I don't remember. I remember seeing Creedence for sure on the Tom Jones show, but I never saw him on. Never saw him on Johnny Cash.
It's interesting that those musical variety shows went the way of the dodo.
Yeah, it's weird, man.
Like when you see something like Jules Holland, like when you're traveling,
it's the best it just seems show
like,
ever.
It's like the most amazing thing.
I've been on that show like six times, something like really? That. Yeah, yeah. And I'm on one of Jules.
Why don't we have that here?
Just because, their music business isn't quite as dead as ours. Right. You know, it's one of those things. It's like. Records still sell more there than they do here. I mean, they're
not. It just
seems
like there's a hunger for that sort of thing.
Yeah. And Jules is like, it's a struggle to keep it going. Like, the most important music program you to get a pop act on is the lottery, you know, in England to this day. You know, I think what's happened is we I grew up in a period when rock and roll was art. It had been elevated. And I took it for granted. But now. Maybe it's not in the mainstream anymore. And that's no insult to anybody that's making in the pop mainstream. And, you know, like the two centers of the music business, they're no longer New York and L.A. It's Atlanta and Nashville. Right. That's where the center, the engines that power what's left of the music business are. Because it's about hip-hop and country.
Right. It's interesting because over the last couple of Foo Fighter album cycles, like we're about to put an album out, so we've been doing like promo and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And we get too. Asked that question more and more, like pretty much every interview. Would there be some version of the like, what's it like to play in a genre that's dead kind of question?
Right.
You know what I mean? Why are you guys still a band? When rock and roll is like not a thing anymore, which I think is a totally ridiculous statement, but we have been asked like that kind of question over and over.
Well, it's a silly thing to ask you guys because you guys are still playing pretty fucking big places.
Sure,
but, you know, so that means it's not dead.
Right. There's a difference between dead and like not in the mainstream.
Well, I think the idea of it being dead is you know, and it's weird because it's been viewed the other way. There was a point at which serious rock writers who took themselves seriously as journalists wouldn't write about Led Zeppelin because 14-year-old boys liked Led Zeppelin.
Right.
And, you know, the truth of the matter is now it's probably the other way. Rock and roll is not dead, but the audience is older. You know, there's a few kids, but kids is a little older, you know. And like the only younger audience I have has all come from the political songs.
Mm.
You know, they're like, and it's kind of weird. It's
well,
like,
you must be getting a lot of them these days.
This new record wasn't that political, but the next one's going to be just as country and really political, probably.
Are you already working on those
songs? I just wrote the first. Well, I wrote a song for Joan Baez that she's recording. Joe Henry's making a Joan Baez record now, and Joan asked me for a song, so I wrote her one. That may end up on our record, too, but I wrote it for Joan because it's pretty cool. It's called Times Like These. And,
oh, really?
yeah, and then I just finished a song that's the centerpiece of the new record, and it's called The Mind, just because the title would be so too long otherwise. But it's about a guy in West Virginia, and him and his girlfriend, and they're addicts, and you know they're kind of struggling along. But he says he's telling her everything's gonna be all right when his brother calls and gets him on at the mine. Hmm. That's when he's gonna straighten up, and that's when everything's gonna get better. Because the truth is, you know. For me, to make a political statement now, it can't be just about rhetoric because that's what lost this election, you know, for my side, is we lost touch with those people. Those people should be voting, you know, for you know, way further to the left than they do. But the reason that they voted for Trump is one issue. He told them that he would keep the coal thing going.
Right.
And the coal thing is dying because there isn't that much coal left, period, under the ground anywhere.
Right,
so it's going to go away. There's not that much oil left either, you know, duh. But we're slow to learn that. So because we know how to make money with that, or they know how to make money with it. Well, it's us. But so you get the idea that there's all of these people in West Virginia that are all employed in the coal industry. And the truth is, it's one in 1,000 person in the average community. And there's way more people in rural areas than you would think. It's a relatively concentrated rural population. They just hope that they're going to get, you know, they hope that the coal mines keep going long enough for them to get that job, because it's the only people they ever see that have anything.
Well, this is the recurring thing. You know, NAFTA is going to be a good thing. And we're going to retrain you when those jobs leave.
Right.
And then that never happened.
Right.
Right. And so that's, I mean, that's the big
$64,000
question.
Checks in the mail and sounds better with
what's
people
gonna replace
in
those, exactly. You know, what's going to replace those jobs? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like, to me, I'm way to the left of just about everybody I know. But I don't think, like, it didn't surprise me at all that a lot of folks did not support Hillary Clinton.
No, it didn't surprise me either, because I voted for her, and I supported Bernie Sanders as long as he was in the race.
Right.
And then when he was gone, I went and voted, and I came down the elevator with a woman, and she was just really uncomfortable, you could see. And she goes, "Well, I did the best that I could do." And I just didn't want to talk to her because I knew that we were probably going to, but she kept talking to herself all the way down the elevator. And finally she goes, "Well, there was just nothing else I could do." And she goes, and I said, and she looked at me and she says, "I voted for, the Green Party candidate." But she had voted for her. And I just bit my tongue, you know, and she goes, "What?" And I said, "Okay, you just voted for Donald Trump." And I believed that, you know, there was no hesitation for me. I didn't fall for Ralph Nader. We have this system that we have, and to think that a third party candidate is viable is just like, it's just not going to happen. And
I think that you see a repeat right now of what happened in 2000 with Nader, who, if you really get into it and kind of split the numbers down, I mean, to me, Ralph Nader did not cost Gore that election. Gore cost Gore that election. He's a shitty, corrupt politician.
I don't think Al Gore was the best candidate in the world.
But I'm saying,
in this case, the numbers do prove that Ralph Nader did cost Gore the election.
Well,
that's a fact, among
other people.
But, well,
and maybe Gore didn't actually even lose for the state of Florida. It's the bigger question to me.
And this one was different because this is a guy that, you know, we had the Electoral College, whenever you have a president elected by, a minority of the popular vote, somebody's going to call foul.
But I think in the same way that nobody really examined the failures of the Gore campaign, because they just, the Democrats wanted people to just blame Nader, so they didn't have to really look at why people didn't vote for Gore.
That's probably
the exact same thing is happening right now with heaping on Bernie Bros or Russia or whatever it is to not look at why people aren't voting.
No, there's not any doubt about that. There's a lot of what this next record is going to be about. This song that I've just written doesn't make any judgments about coal one way or the other. It just tries to tell the story of those people. You know, I want to get to the point where, I'm doing a theater piece that I'm just writing the music for. Some friends of mine are writing a piece. Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen, they wrote The Exonerated, and which is about, you know, exonerated death row inmates, and I was in that. But this is another kind of documentary theater piece where they interviewed all these people that were survivors of Upper Big Branch, which was an explosion in a mine in West Virginia 8 years ago, something like that, 9 years ago. It killed 24 guys. Everybody on the shift died pretty much. Except for a couple of guys that just happened to be almost at the surface, and they got out. Nobody else did. You know, and see, that's the thing. That was a long wall, which is a big, huge machine that cuts a, you know, a like
a face of coal that's like two-thirds the length of a football field wide simultaneously as it pushes into the mountain. And it only takes 24 people to run a longwall that big per shift. Now, that used to be 200 jobs per shift.
Right.
You know, at least 100 in a small mine. You know, because there are people down there digging coal out, there are people loading it, there are people, and, you know, depending on, you got paid according to where you progressed along. Now, it's just basically one guy with no lunch break, you know, and a bottle of pop in one pocket and a sandwich in the other one. He's being paid $100,000 a year. But they're really under pressure to keep the machinery going all the time. And that's why Upper Big Branch happened. They just built up methane behind it because they weren't maintaining it properly and it blew up. And you know, that's always going to happen when you're, you know, when you're making, you know, these were local people that owned this mine too. It wasn't like outsiders like it used to be. But they were making a lot of money, and they made the more money, more coal they took out of there per hour. They were smart. They came in after, you know, coal mining kind of stopped, which means the union died. And after the union had thoroughly died out, they go back in. They say, okay, here's the new deal. We're going to pay you $100,000 a year. Those guys, coal miners are not, you know, the jobs are not poor. They're not living in shacks. They're building houses, you know, that are, you know, out of stone and, you know, like I went to a bunch of people's homes, the most dead animals I've ever seen on walls in my life. And I used to, I grew up hunting and fishing. I don't do it anymore, but I mean, bears and deer, you know, heads all over the walls of these people that we visited, and they were all miners, you know? But the thing is, not everybody has a job, it's a minority of people that do, but all the other people just hope that they're going to get it. Like I said, so, you know, we got to figure out how to reach those people, because they helped elect him. You know, people that don't have jobs in Michigan helped elect him. People that don't have jobs all through the Rust Belt helped elect him. They believed him. It's all about, you know, we get the democracy that we deserve. I really truly believe that. And it's about reaching the right people, but it's also about cultural, you know, responsibility. Maybe reality television does do damage.
Well, yeah, I think Trump is sort of a logical point in where our culture is at.
If you don't believe that reality television's real and Fox is news, then Donald Trump as president of the United States probably isn't possible. It's true. You know, we take steps forward and steps back. You know, the truth of the matter is, you know, this country is not a progressive country, but the world is a progressive place. The human race is progressive.
Right.
We're so much more humane than we were as a species 1,000 years ago. And sometimes all you can do is look at the big picture, because what that's close to you is just, you know, going to bum you out. Right. So I have to kind of, every once in a while, I'll just take a look back and go, you know. Because it's not, I was in Canada right after the election, and somebody said, well, you going to move here? And I said, no, I'm going to go back and fight.
Right.
You know, I just don't know what else to do.
Yeah, that always pisses me off when I hear people going, we're moving to Canada, we're moving to Australia. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, the truth is, those lines I know for a fact aren't really there, because I fly all over the world and I've never seen a line drawn between one place and another. I don't really believe in borders. I consider myself to be a citizen of the world. Nationalism is a very dangerous thing, and it's an extremely dangerous thing right now at this moment. We're in a moment, not just here, it's happening all over the fucking world. Travel, you know, the Netherlands are not what they were 20 years ago, but their election turned out okay. You know, the French election turned out okay. So that's a little hope, you know. But England's been kind of a mess for a while.
Sure. And
it's a real right-wing thing. It's a real racist thing that's there. We don't have any corner on that market.
Yeah. Well, it's tough. You know, if you don't take care of working people and you destroy systems of education and you keep people...
The education
pretty
thing...
Pretty ignorant. You got to expect that there's going to be some bad things that are born out of that.
Absolutely.
I don't blame those folks.
You have to start caring about other people's kids and not just your own. And lefties, this is one thing lefties are definitely guilty of. Talking about education, talking about, you know, you know, healthcare for everybody, talking about a quality education for everybody, but then they put their kids in private school.
Right.
You know, and they help them do their homework.
Guilty.
And then they put them, yeah, you know, that's what I was going to say, because it's one of those deals. At some point, what's going to make public schools better?
Right.
Make private schools illegal and make rich people's kids go to the private schools, and then they'll take care of them. And that sounds radical as hell, and it is, but it's true. It would work. People said, well, that'll never work. No, it won't work because people want to rig the game. If you want to know what's wrong with our educational system, all you need to look no further than George W. Bush got into Yale. Just the fact that he was able right, to fucking right. get in. That's, you know, it was all about a legacy. He was never not going to get in.
See, I dropped out of high school, so I was thinking about it. I was having this college conversation. I got kids that are 13, 11, and 9, so we're a ways
You're
off.
You're getting ready. Well, we're not that far off.
And I was thinking, like, I'm a high school dropout, man. I got no juice with any university anywhere.
So, yeah, well, with me, I haven't gotten one to college yet, you know. I mean, my oldest does what I do, and he's pretty good.
I interviewed him not too long ago.
Yeah, his new record's really good.
Yeah, it's great.
You know, he's got a little girl, by the way, who's he missed it. He was in Europe. I was lucky. I was home when all three boys were born, but he didn't get home. She was a little early, and he didn't get home. So I'll see them in a couple of days. I'm going to fly rather than ride the bus with everybody else to Portland, so I can get there and get a little bit more baby time before we have to
play. Is that where he's living?
Yeah, he's been in Portland the last couple of years, yeah.
I got way off track with all our political stuff there, but I wanted to get more into your new record.
Okay.
So let's backtrack a little bit, go back to that. Who are the outlaw era artists? We all know who the obvious ones are, you know, Waylon and Willie and people like that. But who are the ones that I've never heard of that I should know about?
Well, the part of the story that I think deserves, that everybody needs to hear because he doesn't ever get credit for is Doug Somm. Came back from California right at the same moment that Willie came back from Tennessee to Texas. And Doug moved back to San Antonio, where he's come from, to the neighborhood where I was, enrolled his kids in the school I had just dropped out of. And I followed his daughter home and stood in the driveway till I got to meet Doug Somm. He was our local rock and roll hero. And this is 71 when he moved back. Willie moves back, I think, the same year. He might have been 70. But it was Doug that suggested to Willie that he could play Armadillo World Headquarters rather than just country joints. And he also introduced him to Jerry Wexler. And that's how the Atlantic deal came about. And that's Shotgun Willie and Phases and Stages. So Doug Somm had a lot to do. Because Doug grew up a country musician.
Wasn't he a child prodigy? Child prodigy, pedal steel, and
fiddle, both. And little Dougie Somm. There's pictures of him every dance hall in South Texas.
I think
Texas.
One of his kids is the current drummer for the Meat Puppets.
He is.
I met him down in Austin.
The younger of the two Shandos.
I think I saw someone online was trying to get a documentary made about him.
It's almost made as far as I know. I mean, I sat for an interview for it. We did a big tribute and screened a version of it at South by Southwest 5 years ago, four years ago, I guess. And I sat for a long interview because he's a big deal. Doug Somm,
I feel like he's somebody that people in the know about him, but he doesn't have that.
He was a great guitar player. He was a great singer, you know, and of course he had hits too. Besides She's About a Mover, later after he moved to California, Mendocino and you know, Michoacan, you know, and he, but then he came back to Texas.
And, what was the supergroup called that they had?
The Texas Tornadoes.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was like the first time I saw Doug after I got out of jail. It was like, you know, I've known him since I was a teenager, literally. And he used to, when we were making Copperhead Road, he showed up in Memphis. He was just there and he didn't play, but he was there for nearly all of the sessions, just hung out.
Really?
And then, then later on
would
in the tour.
Would he give you little pearls of wisdom?
Always. Because, I mean, he was pretty supportive. He just, you know, I said in one of the earliest interviews I did what a big deal he was to me, and he read it, and he just, you know, appreciated the fact that I saw him as, you know, he was our local rock and roll hero. He was the biggest deal, you know, somebody that's local, you know. I mean, I stood in his driveway, and he came outside, and he was real, and then I met Townsend Zant when I was 17. So I was there that moment just before just as Willie moved back, I was in Texas still. And then between the time that Shotgun Willie came out and just before the Redheaded Stranger came out, I moved to Nashville. So I kind of saw it from both sides.
Right.
You know, I was at the Dripping Springs reunion, bought a ticket, was there. I was at the first 4th of July picnic, bought a ticket, and was there. Yeah. So I saw Waylon Jennings, one of his first appearances, I think, after he took the grease out of his hair, which was the Avid Homecoming, and everybody gasped when he walked on stage. It was hilarious.
Was that when he officially became an outlaw?
Yeah,
let it all hang down.
You know, the term outlaw, people, and that's what this title was about, was, you know, an Australian interviewer the other day said, so it's really about your lifestyle, what you guys are doing, right? Not about, and I said, no, it was about country artists that, through Doug Somm, and I really think that's the beginning of it, discovering that rock artists had at least nominally a level of artistic freedom that they couldn't imagine.
Right.
And they just wanted to be able to make records like that. And when they fought for it and they did it, then people in Nashville called them outlaws.
It's funny, Dave Cobb, I recorded my last album out in Nashville with Dave Cobb, and he told me that, like, way later than you would think, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but it was shocking to me, that, like, country artists weren't even allowed to come into the control room.
Yeah.
On their sessions.
Yeah.
Like, the first time they heard their song mixed would be on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Chet Atkins worked like that. A lot of people worked like that. I never had that happen, but I didn't start making records till the mid-80s.
Right.
And
so Outlaw was about, like, taking back control.
Taking the control. And there's been, you know, periods of... Nashville's a very controlling musical environment, and... You know, there'd been periods before, but there was sort of a lot of it going on. When I got to Nashville, the inmates were in charge of the asylum, but the window closed really quickly before I could get a record deal. I got a publishing deal, but I didn't get a record deal. So I had to wait for 12 years to another, I refer to as the great credibility scare of the mid-1980s. and it was, a lot of it was Tony Brown decided that singer-songwriters might be the future of country music.
Right.
He signed me, Lyle Lovett, Nancy Griffith, and... And, you know, people identified me, Dwight Yoakam, and I tried to get Tony to sign Dwight, but he passed. Because I took the very first copy of Dwight's EP, which was the original EP version of what became the Guitars and Cadillacs. Dwight and I had the same path. We both made independent records.
Right.
And major labels picked them up and expanded them. I had a 4-cut EP. He had a 6-cut EP. And then they recorded more tracks. And it had the same cover, everything else in his case. In my case... The expanded version of my EP never came out, and the label dropped me, and then I got a deal immediately with MCA and made Guitar Town. And so by the time Dwight's revamped album based on his EP came out, they came out, I think, the same day. I think they were literally released the same day. I know Randy Travis's record was released the same day as mine. So we got lumped together, you know, called New Traditionalists, which isn't what I was. I don't know whether... you have to ask Dwight and Randy whether they consider themselves to be that or not.
Well, so I read a quote of yours where you said that this new album was like a philosophical follow-up to, I think it was, Guitar Town.
Well, there was a joke. I said, when I realized what the record was going to be, people were asking about it. I said, well, it might be the record that I might have made if Jimmy Bowen hadn't pissed me off after Guitar Town. And that's not exactly what it is, because, like I said, it's almost like a prequel. You know, because it's based on, you know, because I didn't play electric guitar until I was 26 or 27. And that resulted in the Rockabilly record. And then Guitar Town, I didn't play any electric guitar on that record. On the second record, I played electric on one song.
Right.
And I sort of became an acoustic guitar player that played electric from time to time. In the 90s, when I got out of jail, I tended to make acoustic records or electric records. And the electric records, there'd be a couple of acoustic tracks on it, but most of them I'd just play electric guitar.
Right.
I've always been terrified of Fender Telecasters. And it's a very unforgiving guitar.
Incredibly. And I had the same issue with
them
for a long time.
My guitars were, I just got a 55, you know, TV, you know, Les Paul special.
Oh, yellow one? Cutaway?
No, a single, because they don't become double cutaways. Start 60.
Okay, see, this is really good. I get more feedback on my podcast with people wanting to know about, like, really specific gear stuff.
Yeah,
like, you wouldn't think people would give a shit about that, but people would love to hear.
You're
going to
get guitar players
gear.
Listening to your podcast,
right.
So they're going to be guitar nerds.
So go hog wild. Let's hear all about your vintage gear collection.
Well, I got a lot of stuff. I don't have a lot of amps anymore. I just went through a divorce, so I sold a lot of stuff. So I decided. You know what? I only need to keep three amps. I kept one small Gibson I can't even remember the model number. It's one of the ones that's letters and numbers from the 50s that I kept. I mainly use it as a harp amp, but I could also use it around the house. And I kept an AC-50.
And AC-50?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen one of those.
Well, yeah, you have too. If you've seen Charlie Sexton play with Bob Dylan back in the 90s and turn of the millennium, that was Charlie played through for years. I've got an AC-50 and I've got a 59 Bassman. And I use one. It's a 59 410 Bassman. Wow. I like 410s. I like 50 watts, but the AC-50 likes 12. So I've got a Scumbag cabinet that he built. That's kind of a cool cabinet because it has a back that you can close it. You can open it and you can, it's basically ratcheted. So you can literally tune it to the room by the open back function. Now you can close it and it does that Marshall thing. Cause those are the forerunner of the Plexis, the AC-50s, the 50 watt,
I didn't know that.
The 50 watt boxes are the forerunner of the 50 watt Marshalls.
My tech had to make these little cover things for the back of my AC-30s.
Right.
Cause our keyboard player was just getting
killed.
His head blasted off every
night. I turn my, when you're looking, on the road, I use PV Classic 50s and I have for years.
Really?
Because you can't blow them up. They sound great, I think. With 410s, I used to use them with 810s with an extension cabinet, and they really sound great when you do that, but it's stupid loud. And it's also tall, so it's tearing everybody's head off. I carry two of those 50-watt PVs. And the one you're seeing on stage is not the one I'm playing through. It's the spare.
That's one of those.
The one
you got
in
them off stage.
No, they're right there. I just put them back to back.
Oh, okay.
I made everybody turn their amps around. All of our amps are facing backwards.
Do you go like in ears or?
Yeah, we're in ears.
Right, okay.
But it's basically in ears does two things. It gets, if you can get all the speakers where none of them are firing at the microphones, your front of house guy has to do it takes two-thirds of his job away. He just, it's way easier just to mix the show if you already have don't use the drum risers to get the drums up really high. We got the drums on the floor and my drummer, his cymbals are really low. I've got a lot of hearing loss, and it's mostly from cymbals.
For sure.
Like cymbals are the things that hurt you.
Because they're right there.
Yeah, but Telecasters scared me, and I've had a 55 Telecaster for years. But when I decided I was essentially going to I wrote the first song, which was If Mama Could Have Seen Me, because T-Bone Burnett asked me for a song for the first, the first season of Nashville. And it was a character who had a brother that got out of prison, and the brother had written a song. For some reason, he thought I was qualified to compose that piece of material. So
if I go back and watch that episode, is that the song?
It's in there. It's in the first season somewhere.
I remember that episode.
Yeah. And they used it the second season. Buddy Miller took over.
Right.
And he asked me for a song, and I wrote "Looking for a Woman," and they didn't use it. He liked it, but he had a boss. He had a music supervisor once T-Bone was gone that over him. And I think because they didn't have the publishing, they didn't use it. And because I don't do that. And,
that's the song on your record that has one of my favorite things that is very outlaw, which is Phaser.
Yeah, that's on Chris's guitar, not mine.
Okay.
And
love some Phaser and some country.
Yeah, well, that's what Waylon did all the time. He used a Phase 45, and he just did it. Phase 45 on basically the lowest setting, and he just left it on all the time.
Right. Yeah. That's a good sound.
Yeah, it sounds great. And Looking for a Woman, all that stuff. Basically, what I wrote those two songs, and when I got to the Colvin and Earl album and thinking about the next record, I got those songs out, and what's the vibe here? These kind of go together, and I realized I've been listening to Honky Tonk Heroes again. So I surrendered to that, and I decided, well, that's what this record. Very shortly after that, I came up with the title, wrote So You Want to Be an Outlaw, and immediately wanted Willie to sing it, and I asked him, and he said yes, and so... All three of those songs are essentially riff rock in the sense that they're country songs based on a riff, based on a guitar riff. So the clearer the sound is, and that's the way Waylon Jennings records were. And that was the difference with Honky Tonk Heroes. He finally got to be build records around the way he played guitar, because he was a great guitar player.
And really?
Very original.
Did he play the lead on some of it, on those?
Yeah, records? A lot of it is. I mean, on Honky Tonk Heroes and records after that, you know. And one of his biggest hits, one of my favorite Waylon records, is a live record. And he's really playing just rhythm, because the lead is Ralph Moon on Steel's Rainy Day Woman. Mm. That's probably my favorite Waylon record, my favorite, you know, Waylon single. But I just need
to say that Willie sang on So You Want to Be an Outlaw?
Yeah, Willie's on the second verse. That's Willie also.
Oh, I didn't even put that together.
Yeah.
Wow, because I knew that there's Johnny Bush is on.
Johnny Bush is on. Yeah. Willie's on. Yeah, I had all the rest of the guest vocals are live. Miranda's live. She came to Austin, was there when we cut the track.
How'd that come together?
It was Miranda and I have known each other for a while, sort of casually. She wrote a song years ago that, you know, she decided sounded too much like one of mine, and I hadn't even heard it. I knew who she was, but I wasn't really listening. I didn't listen to country radio that much when I was on it.
Mm.
And I hadn't heard it. But her manager called my manager and said, look, we think this is pretty close to one of Steve's songs, so we're just going to give him half of it. And that was Kerosene.
Really?
Which I was, you know, I was paying a lot of alimony then, just like I am now. So I accepted the gift, you know, gracefully and graciously. I just kind of, you know, we knew each other a little bit, but then it turned out after Allison and I got together, they were friends and they got their hair cut at the same place. And I literally met her at the beauty shop, dropping Allison off and picking Allison up to get her hair done right after we got married. We were still sort of 1 foot in Nashville, 1 foot in New York. So we, Guy Clark, the last few years of his life, started co-writing a lot, and I decided that I was going to do that, that I was going to go back to Nashville and just make some writing appointments and see what happened.
Mm.
And I made a bunch of appointments in the first batch. It took a while to get it together. It was one with Miranda, and we wrote that song.
So you wrote that together?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know.
And the Willie thing, I had to go to Maui, poor me, and get his vocal on that. But, you know, I've started going to Maui every Christmas anyway, so it's like,
you know, his son lives like two blocks that way.
Yeah, is that where?
Yeah, he's Lucas right in the neighborhood.
Yeah,
Lucas.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
I just saw both kids. I tell you, Lucas is great. The band is great.
Yeah,
Micah can play, man. Yeah, and he can. But Micah is like very quietly. He's got his whole own other thing, and
this is
something kind of out there for Micah. I think when he says something really cool.
Well, it's okay. So tell me about working with Johnny Bush. Is that somebody that you've known for a long time?
Yeah, a long, long time.
Was he like a presence in Texas? I mean,
big deal in San Antonio for sure. He's from Houston, but he lives in San Antonio. He's actually, you know, just went through, he's got some heart stuff going on. He was just
like,
in the hospital.
Still active,
just got home.
Touring?
Yeah, he was. I saw him at the 4th of July picnic. He was there that day too. I got a picture in here of me and him on it. He travels on Ray Price's old bus. He
really?
Bought Ray's old, you know, the last bus that Ray toured on. It's like a 65 or 66.
Had he been in Ray's band? Isn't that like how
both
he got
a star? And Willie Nelson, Roger Miller, they all were in Ray Price's band at the same time.
When that one section comes in that he sings just not doing harmony, when it's just his voice, it's crazy. Like that guy's, people just sang different back then. It just sounds like that guy.
They called him the Country Caruso, but it's something he kind of, Ray Price sort of started it, but he took it to a whole nother level. There's another guy called Daryl McCall who sings sort of the same way. And Daryl and John do these duets together sometimes that are incredible. And it's just, The country music in South Texas is different. It's danceable, number one. It kind of has to be. So the musicians also played rock and roll, and all the country bands I ever saw played Bad Men Rising, and they played, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just one of those things. And you could dance, you know, you could teach.
I like
that
put a couple shuffles on your record.
Yeah,
the shuffle has gone the way of the dodo, has it not? I mean, that's, you don't hear any of these like all
down
country
there,
people
do.
Doing it.
Down there, people still do it, you know.
Really?
Reckless Kelly plays shuffles and you know, because they a lot of times John has a great band. In fact, a guitar player I grew up with, I saw him come up as a country guitar player in his dad's band, a guy named Wayman McBride, and his dad was a tile setter by trade, but had one of the best local country bands in San Antonio called Cliff McBride and the Fugitives, and saw him playing country in his dad's band. Then he went into my uncle's band in his rock band, which was sort of an Allman Brothers twin guitar and keyboards, you know, kind of progressive, you know, rock band. But Waylon's in Johnny Bush's band these days, and he's fact, he drove John to the sessions in Austin, and it was that was great. And Waylon's a guitar collector too, and he's like, there's a guitar. Waylon just sent me a picture. He got a L5 that belonged to a guy named Bucky Meadows, and Bucky was a sort of a guitar player around Texas, around from Houston, but he'd pop up in Nashville every once in a while too. And I remember him driving around in one of those. Oh, what was those? It was a Dodge Omni. Remember those? It was sort of like a Dodge version of a Gremlin, little hatchback with a kind of domed back.
Yeah.
And he drove around one of those with this big white German Shepherd and a big, huge Fender amp in the back and that L5. And he wore a derby all the time. And he'd drive that car back and forth between Nashville and Houston and play sessions. And that sort of jazzy sounding electric guitar on Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, that's Bucky.
Oh,
and
really?
He passed away a few years ago, and my friend Wayne McBride just bought his L5, and he didn't even like, you know, explain it. He just texted me the picture, and I knew exactly what I was looking at because I'd seen that guitar so many times.
Right.
I'd love to own that guitar.
So I read that you've been working on your autobiography.
It's really a literary memoir. It's largely about recovery. It's called I Can't Remember If We Said Goodbye, and I'm working on it now, and I'm trying to finish it before the end of the year.
What's that been like, sort of dredging through?
No, it's awful because it's not. I mean, look, when in my novel, I didn't know that my cross dressing, you know, ex football star prostitute was going to kill my priest until the night before it happened. You know, and it was there were surprises. When you're writing about yourself, you know how it ends.
Right.
So sometimes it's hard to. You just get sick of it. You get sick of yourself. You get sick of waking up in the morning and, you know, going in and. And trudging through your shit.
I mean, that's interesting because that's like your songwriting. There's one of the songs on the record. I think it was News from Colorado.
I thought that
seems more like, you know, that's a story that you're writing than your life story.
It's a made up story,
you know?
But it actually was begun by my niece. That's a co-written song. It was begun by my niece, Emily Earle, and my ex-wife, Al Sonora. And they started it. And Emily's from Colorado. And, you know, it's not, her family isn't, you know, dysfunctional the way the family in the song is, but I think with her, there was some stuff going on that she had moved away on purpose just to have a life because she's a singer and a songwriter. And, you know, just that idea of like, you know, that call from home isn't always good news. It's a great idea. They came up with that, and I think Emily sort of said it, and Allison decided it was a title, and they started working on it. And they were working on it. And it was either right before Allison and I split up or right after when I was like in Tennessee, because originally she'd gone to Tennessee and that's where my kid was. So I had to go there if I wanted to see my kid. And it was either just before, just after, I don't remember which. Just know I was there. And I kept hearing him working on it. And I wanted to sing it. And so I intervened and finished it. And so it's not my story.
Right. But so writing your actual story for your book, was that less fun than...
Sometimes it's a lot of fun
because,
especially if you can hit it, like, I'm trying to make it. I've decided the way I'm finishing it is I'm going back and trying to find, take the stories, the anecdotes that I think need to be in there and just forget about the chronology right now and not try to, I'm just writing them, compiling them, and then I'll stitch them together.
Have you got a sense yet of like the moral of the story? Like, you know, I don't know if you ever read like Johnny Cash's autobiography.
Yeah,
it was like
yeah.
so great, and you just felt like it was like very wise. And then I read that one, and then I read George Jones's I Live to Tell It All.
Right.
And there was no lesson learned. You know what
no.
I mean? The lesson was like, if she hadn't made me do all that cocaine, I wouldn't have, you know,
right.
like that sort of thing. You know,
yeah.
So what's the lesson? What's the moral of the story for your book?
It's called, you know, I Can't Remember If We Said Goodbye. It's not so much about a moral as it is, but it's in three acts. The first part is about a little bit about growing up, but mainly about getting to Nashville and towns as a mentor. And it has a lot to do with mentors. The second part, it sort of goes up to Guitar Town, you know. And then the second part is about the street and jail. And guys that I looked up to they didn't have my best interests at heart, but without them, I wouldn't have survived. You know, so they were preying on me, but they also were protecting me at the same time. So helped me get through the experience. So the second part's about them and that. And the third part,
I don't recall hearing it like that story. I don't recall hearing you tell that story. So is that a part of your life?
I've told it some. I mean, and it's been in some songs to some degree, but it's not like you know, the reason that inmates started writing me was because I'd been locked up for a very short period of time, and they just thought that there was some language that we had between us since we had that in common. And that's probably true, you know. It's, you know, it's about a little bit of it's about it's, it really starts in LA because it was just kind of where I thought I'd bottomed out. And my ex-wife took me to Texas and tried to dump me there at my parents' house. And then I somehow managed to find my way to Tennessee where she was. And then we got back together for a short period of time, but I kept ripping and running in Tennessee. She thought getting me out of LA was going to get me clean. It just made it harder to, and more expensive to get drugs, but it didn't mean I wasn't going to do it.
Sure.
You know, LA was easy. Just drive down to Alvarado Street and that was it.
Yeah.
It wasn't hard at all. And the cops were so worried about crack, they weren't fucking with the heroin spots.
Right.
You know, then I started smoking crack. So
that must have all changed. I mean, I don't remember exactly where that all was. But I remember that.
I bet you it's probably like a pour over coffee joint now. I bet you if we get in a car and we drive to Hoover and Alvarado right now, it's still sketchy. There's somebody standing right there right now.
Like, when's the last time you were in downtown LA? It is very different than it was. You know,
it is, but Hoover and Alvarado, I bet isn't that different. It
hasn't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
So when's that going to come out? When's the book going to come out?
I'm hoping early next year.
What's next for you? I mean, you're pretty new into this record, so you're just going to be on the road for a while.
The records, I know what the next record's going to be. I've got a couple of theater projects I'm working on. I've got a...
But are you touring this one for...
Oh, yeah. It's what we're doing right now. We're going to be touring with the band in the States until October. The first week in October, Hardly Strictly Bluegrass is the last date for this year with the band. Well, that's not true. We're going to go back out in December. We're going to do another 2 or 3 weeks in December. We'll end up at the benefit for my son's school that we do every year in New York City. The second week in December, we'll probably go on to about, you know, right up to almost Christmas in North America. Then we're going to break, and I'll do November. The band is, there's a break because I'm going to go to Australia solo and open for Paul Kelly. He's put together this big tour.
I just interviewed him too.
Yeah. I've known Paul for a long time. And he just really wanted me to come, and it didn't work out money wise for me to take the band. So I'm just going by myself and opening that 3 weeks and come back. And then we'll go back out with the band. Then next year, you know, I do a residency at the City Wineries solo in January and February. We'll do the Outlaw Country Cruise with the band. And then we'll start back out again because we're not letting this record go for a while.
You are a busy man.
We'll be out in the spring. We'll probably go back to Australia in the spring with the band. Tour in the States until probably Europe is going to, for this record's going to be, I kind of need to wait for the festivals to make it make sense money wise. So we're going to go, it's either the last week in June or the first week in July. We just don't know which weekend of the festival that we're anchoring it to that we're playing yet.
So
June, July is going to be Europe basically. And then, we'll just, you know, I have bills to pay. So we'll be working, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
at some point, probably by next summer, the songs for this record will be pretty much done and we'll start thinking about recording. And then probably before the tour is actually over, I really want to, because we kind of did it with this record because we did the Guitar Town tour and went straight into the studio.
Right.
And I really, the more I get to play this stuff, you know, live before we record it, the better I like it.
So you're already doing like some new songs, throwing them in the set?
We haven't thrown anything new in the set yet. What we just started running with the band, started rehearsing the very first song I've written for the record, which is this song that's called The Mine that I think may be the centerpiece of the next record.
Are the Dukes a standalone band in their own right?
They don't ever do that. They could. I mean, the Mastersons, my guitar player and fiddle player, they make records on their own as a duo. The Dukes could do that. Kelly Looney sings and he makes records, and my bass player's been in the band since 1988, you know, and Brad Pemberton's in the band now, who was in the Cardinals, Ryan Adams band, for 10 years, and we had our drummer of 15 years left right before Australia the last time. Brad came in, rehearsed the whole show in one rehearsal, and we went to Australia, and he's great, and he likes to travel and likes to play, and he's, you know, Sometimes it can be a pleasure to be trapped on a... When you've been doing it as long as I have, it's like, you know, I've been in bands, had people out in bands, people I've worked with that, you know, I was really attached to them being there. I liked what they did. I was comfortable with it, but they were just starting to get, you know, not that happy to be there. And the deal is you can't fight the road, man. You have to surrender to it or you're fucked. It'll eat you alive. It's a hard thing, especially the way we do it. We're lucky we're still on the bus, you know, but we're like, we play six shows a week. We roll after every show, go to the next town, wake up, usually two cleanup rooms, go to the venue, you know, camp out.
How do you take care of your voice? Because being the singer on a tour is a very different tour to everybody else in the band.
My struggles with my voice are never my vocal cords. My voice probably sounds a little pinched right now, or it does to me, but it's my chest closing up because I've got some COPD. I quit smoking about 10 years too late. Mm. But it's treatable. Yoga has helped a lot with that. I breathe so much better than I just played a show in Aspen, which I used to suffer through those shows at 8,000 feet. Mm. I had no problem whatsoever. And that's yoga. That's completely and totally. I started practicing yoga 6 days a week about a year and a half ago.
Oh, wow.
It's been a life-changing thing.
Right.
Huge, huge, huge thing. You know, you that's lose weight. But you also, it's a meditation system. That's what it really is.
Right.
But you also, it's for breathing. It's because all yoga poses are breathing exercises, you know? So it really, really helps your lungs a lot. It's great for singers.
That's one of those things, like so many things, that is on my list of things to do. And I haven't gotten to it yet.
You should do it.
I know. Because I'm at that age now where I'm just a map of aches and pains.
Yeah.
From years of being a ding-dong.
I'm thinking about a cortisone shot in this elbow. I have the guitar player tennis elbow thing.
Right, in spades.
Right. You know, especially, you know, we're playing six nights a week. My arm, and it's 2 hours. Yeah. Show's 2 hours. And
solid.
I play
keep on trucking.
Guitar and mandolin through, you know, every single song. So.
Yeah, good. Yeah,
you get sore.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah, I can't use that. I use thumb picks most of the time. I can use it, but I haven't done it in a long time. I don't have one of my picks with me. Let me think what I can do here.
I love her now, yes I always
Mary's wheel. You ever did that? That drop, dropping you with the...
All right, yeah, that was Mr. Steve Earle doing an exclusive walking the floor version of The Girl on the Mountain from his latest record, So You Wanna Be an Outlaw. Check out SteveEarle.com or at Steve Earle on the Twitter to check out everything that's going on with Steve Earle, including all his tour dates that stretch from now to like through the fall into the winter, I think, and probably beyond that. Go check him out for sure. All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with my guest Tyler Childers, who has a fantastic record out called Purgatory that you got to listen to. That's your homework assignment for the week. Listen to that leading into my interview with him that I'll be posting next week. Okay, now don't forget, there's the Walking the Floor playlist on Spotify that you can check out through my artist profile up there. So if you just go to Chris Shiflett, you'll find the Walking the Floor playlist. I put some new tracks in there. I've been pretty lazy so far about stocking that thing with fresh music, but I just put a few new tracks in there, and I really want to get people to follow it. We've got like 300 followers right now, but we need like, you know, 500,000. So we're a little shy of the target goal of where we want to be. So everybody listening, go follow it and get your mom to follow it and get your cousin to follow it and your girlfriend and your dog, and then we'll be in good shape. All right. I love you. This is Chris Shiflett from Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos!